Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Returning now to our coverage of the Occupy Boston story. Today, a judge said she would rule by the middle of this month on whether the city has the right to evict the protesters from Dewey Square. In the meantime, her restraining order protecting them from eviction remains in effect. At issue in this case, free speech rights versus public safety.
Boston Mayor Tom Menino says there are no plans to evict the protesters, but he wants the right to do so in case health or safety issues make it necessary. Lawyers for the protesters argued in court today that the Dewey Square camp is an act of free speech and must be protected.
But whether the city evicts the protesters or lets them stay, what is next for Occupy Boston? Can it survive without its Dewey Square presence? And if it digs in for the winter, then what? We're going to explore those questions now, and we'd like to hear from you. Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And we're joined in the studio now by Professor Timothy McCarthy. He's director of the Human Rights and Social Movements Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's the author of several books, including Protest Nation, Words That Inspired a Century of American Radicalism. And Tim McCarthy, great to have you. Thanks for coming to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So let me just ask you about the court case first. Members of Occupy Boston were in court today, as we mentioned, and they basically argued that the tent city in Dewey Square is protected speech because it's a symbolic expression of what they call the possibility of a fair and democratic and economically egalitarian society. In other words, the encampment itself is the message. Do you agree with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do agree with the sentiment, the argument that this does represent a form of free speech. But I think that the argument to be made actually needs to be broader. It needs to appeal to all of the components of the First Amendment, which are free speech, of course, but also freedom of assembly, petition, press, religion, etc. And I would make that argument. I'd make it even a broader First Amendment argument that doesn't just restrict this to a free speech discourse, but actually talks about assembly, petition, press, etc., because all of these things are actually, with the possible exception of freedom of religion, are actually at stake in the occupation.
You see, it's so interesting. The reason why I wanted to ask you about it and sort of start with the court decision is because I'm just interested in trying to find out if we can separate the actual physical expression of this movement in a tented encampment in Boston from the sort of broader protest movement that it represents.
Well, I think that that's what the powers that be and the lawyers who are on their side are actually going to try to do. They're going to try to parse out the First Amendment and try to create these distinctions, which are ultimately artificial distinctions that undermine, I think, the comprehensive perspective on freedom that the First Amendment actually guarantees. And if the occupiers themselves, if the movement itself begins to embrace a much broader First Amendment claim that includes both speech and assembly, as well as press and petition, that's a much more aggressive, a much bolder, and a much more American claim that I think would actually be more, that would resonate more with a larger structure of society that would allow people to see what the powers that be and what the lawyers that are on their side are actually trying to do by parsing this out.
Interesting. Now, across the country this week, from Philadelphia, California, Seattle, we've seen police evict and shut down these camps. Does it look to you like this initial phase of this protest movement is drawing to a close? And if so, what comes next?
Well, I think that, one could interpret it that way. I think it's too early to tell, frankly, whether because there are so many different approaches being taken in different jurisdictions across the country. Some are being much more repressive. Some are being much more lenient. But I don't think that the point of this was ever to have these tent cities or these occupations exist in perpetuity. What matters, I think, to the movement, whether or not it becomes the kind of full-fledged movement, is how persistent it is, how it can turn these tent cities into a tenacious form of criticism that will last over a long term. That's what movements need to drive them. So I don't think that, while I think the spaces are symbolic and important for a whole host of reasons, I don't think that they're necessarily everything about the movement. I think the movement has many more strategies and resources available to it that will help it sustain itself over a longer period of time.
Interesting. Listeners, we're talking about the Occupy Boston movement, the Occupy Wall Street movement, and asking what comes next. And let's assume that eventually the protesters are evicted. Can it survive? Give us a call, 800-423-TALK. You can also call 800-423-8255 and find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. With me is Timothy McCarthy of the Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. And let me introduce a member of Occupy Boston who's thinking about the future of the movement as well. Timothy McCarthy. McCarthy is with me in the studio, and I'm sorry, Philip Anderson is with me in the studio. And Philip, you've been working to bring the Occupy movement into the suburbs and the living rooms, away from that Dewey Camp, Dewey Square encampment. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So myself and a few friends who were all members of Occupy Boston created a website. It's www.wecanoccupy.org. And the goal of this organization is to help decentralize the movement and engage more people in it. Because as we say, we're representing the 99%. And by the nature of the encampments, a lot of people aren't able to come down if they have family commitments, if they have work commitments, if they have, you know, if they have issues with disabilities and they just can't make it down to camp. So we really wanted to make people feel that they were a part of a movement, because we often heard in the suburbs and in parts of the inner city that people supported the movement, that they agreed with what the movement was doing, but rarely did we hear that they were a part of a movement, that they actually felt that their voice was directly guiding where the discussion goes about Occupy. And so the goal of this, and it's in its early stages, we just put up our full website, is to have people host events at their homes, churches, schools, VFWs, really any place, hence the weekend Occupy. So you occupy whatever space you can, and you spark a discussion in that place and talk about issues that are close to their hearts and on a broader scale. So if your town has a specific issue with school funding, that's important. That's part of the Occupy movement. If you want to talk about the broader issues of the financial crisis, you're welcome to do that as well. It's really to just get people engaged and make them feel that they're really a part of it.
So it really sounds like you're looking ahead to the day when that encampment is no longer the sort of center of the protest movement. And is that important to think about?
I think it's extremely important to think about. I agreed with Professor McCarthy in saying that the encampments have done a great job demonstrating what a community of people working together can achieve, what the benefits of a horizontal participatory democracy are. But you have to have contingency plans. We have groups within the camp figuring out maybe other places to occupy if the camp's raided, about, you know, indoor places to occupy. And so this is just another, you know, contingency in the event that the camps are raided or self-evicted, as we like to call it, if we make a decision at some point through the General Assembly to leave Dewey Square. And also, this is just kind of moving away from the encampment idea in general, just that there are a lot of people who have ideas about where this movement should go. Some people are more political about it. Some people are more revolutionary about it. And we want to have all those voices. So extending it out to the suburbs, into the inner cities, to places that can't really get to camp, we think is extremely important.
Tim McCarthy, you've studied the history of protest movement. What strikes you? I mean, listening to Phil, what strikes you about the way the Occupy movement is evolving?
Well, I think the physical occupation has been very important and powerful and symbolic in this early phase of the movement, and we still are in a very early phase of this. I also think that it's very smart strategically to try to diversify a set of strategies moving forward, because I think that the more diverse the strategies are, the more diverse the people are who can be part of this movement or can see themselves as part of it. If you think about the civil rights movement, which is a great example of a sort of modern protest movement that sustained itself and was also powerful, you think about all the different strategies that took place, the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955 and 1956, to the sit-in movement that began in 1960s, which was really an occupation-like movement, to the freedom rides of several years after that, and then the Mississippi Freedom Summer, which was itself an occupation of Mississippi by black folks and white and black college students who went to Mississippi during that summer. All of those strategies, bus boycotts, sit-ins, freedom rides, the Mississippi Freedom Summer, all of those things gave people different ways of entering into the movement, different ways of connecting to strategies for social transformation and political engagement. And I think if the movement starts to think, and it is beginning, it's very clear whether people are paying attention to those conversations or not is another question. But it's very clear to me from the folks that I know who are part of this movement, myself, and the conversations I've been having with colleagues and comrades, it's that this movement is seeking to diversify its strategy, is seeking to diversify the number of places that are constituted by this movement, that are occupied by this movement, and ultimately the broad range of institutions and ideas and people that can be influenced by it over a long term.
You know, it's interesting that you brought up the civil rights movement, and I want to ask you about that, because here's a big difference that I see, and of course the civil rights movement evolved over time, but the focus was so singular. I mean, it was about racial equality. the Occupy Wall Street movement doesn't have that sort of singular focus yet. Does it need to?
Well, I think we romanticize the civil rights movement. I think that one of the things that's been so interesting to me is the way that so many people talk to me about, oh, if you just did things like the civil rights movement did, or the living wage campaign did, or the anti-apartheid movement did. Those movements were vilified, maligned, marginalized, misunderstood at the time. So is this movement. When you engage in this kind of activism, when you fundamentally challenge the institutions of power in society and the people that control those institutions, you are up against a Sisyphean feat of trying to push that rock up that mountain. And the fact of the matter is, Dr. King didn't get to the mountaintop. And some of us may not get to the mountaintop. But this movement is being misunderstood like all those other movements have before. The idea of racial equality in 1954, 1955, or 1956, to say nothing of the abolitionists who were the precursors to the Black Civil Rights Movement folks, the idea of racial equality was as crazy as critiquing our political and economic systems today is in this era.
Interesting. So it seemed far-fetched and
totally far-fetched. And people were always asking, right. Well, what do you want? What do you want? I want freedom. Freedom what? Freedom now. Right? And at the end of the day, freedom, equality, these are big concepts, but they're fundamentally American concepts, which is why I think the strategy rhetorically and politically has to be embedded in these fundamental American freedoms of speech, assembly, petition, press, religion, and so forth, because that's the most American thing there is. We're not socialists and foreigners and freaks. Yeah. We're people who want to make this country a better union.
Philip Anderson, let me get you back in this conversation. You're nodding your head. I mean, I asked the question, provocative, obviously, about this need for a sort of singular focus in the Occupy Boston movement, Wall Street movement. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think that we might not have a singular focus, but we have more broad focuses that can be considered, you know, things that are guiding the movement, such as economic equality, political equality, much like the civil rights were advocating for racial equality, because that had a lot of subpoints under it, much like these issues have. And I agree with it's like trying to push the rock up a hill, but there's actually people above trying to push it back down.
Oh, absolutely.
Which would be, you know.
There's always someone who gets to the mountaintop before you
do.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And I think, again, it's a young movement. Mm-hmm. Boston just celebrated its second month birthday yesterday. And we're still kind of getting a handle on what the issues even are. The war is one issue, and that's been going on for a decade. And the financial crisis has been going on, you could argue, for decades, multiple ones. So it's taking a little while to even get a handle on what the problems are. And I also think the advantage to a leaderless movement like we have and with multiple messages is it protects us really from the propagandists who are excellent at maligning one message or maligning one leader. This kind of makes it difficult. We don't have that 30-second soundbite that they can run and just, you know, attack every single news cycle. They are trying to get a handle on what our messages are. And it's because we have so many. We're representing the 99%. And by the nature of that, we're representing a lot of frustrations and grievances that people have. And we will start to boil those down, and we have been. I mean, corporate money in politics, Citizens United, accountability in the economic and the political sector are all things that most of the occupations agree on. Our General Assembly has ratified some of those.
Mm-hmm.
But also our General Assembly has ratified something called diversity of tactics and diversity of ideas. And it's really saying, if you have an idea that maybe not everyone agrees with, still go out, you know, and try and broadcast that idea. So
I want to get some callers in, so just hold that thought. Sure. I know, Tim, you were just about to chime in there. We're talking to Timothy McCarthy of the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and Phil Anderson. He's an Occupy Boston protesters and one of the folks behind the website WeCanOccupy.com. We've got a lot of callers on the line. Matt is calling from Holliston.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate the show. I understand and, you know, recognize the Occupy movement, a few of their messages, raising awareness for the inequality in the 99.1%. But do they also realize the problem ends up falling in terms of the cost of litigation and the cost of police presence and cleanup and all that stuff actually falls on the burden of the taxpayer, which is actually not harming the corporations at all, or it's not getting to their wallets. It's actually impacting us, the people, and I'll take my comment off the air.
All right, Matt, great point. Let me come to you, Phil, first on that. I mean, this might be an argument for Matt for you know, moving beyond these camps. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but your response.
Yeah, that's been brought up before, especially by the Boston Police Department and by the city of Boston. They're saying that overtime for police has reached around $600,000. But the thing they don't really say is that that's already allocated money. We've used about 2% of the already allocated overtime money. So they're really just moving police officers around to have more details at Occupy Boston. And we also make the argument that this money is also being spent frivolously. I mean, they have multiple helicopters in the air on marches. That's burning money. They bring 200 riot police to deal with, you know, a few hundred protesters. That's burning money. They bring the special units in. I think a lot of it is when they have a march, they have all these new toys that they're getting under, like, Homeland Security grants, and they want to bring them out. I mean, in New York, they used LRADs against us, the long-range acoustic devices, all kinds of flashy trucks and surveillance equipment. So I think that there is money being spent. Most of it has already been budgeted. But also, you know, the taxes that you're paying may be going to maybe paying for some of that, but we think that what we're trying to do kind of outweighs what spending might have to occur. We're not trying to burn through too much money, but if that's, you know, an externality of this, I think it's going to be positive in the end.
Let's get another call from Michael, who's calling from Weymouth. Hi, Michael.
Hi there. How's it going?
Very well. What's on your mind?
So I'm a paramedic, and I've been volunteering in the Occupy Boston medical tent since just about the get-go. And I have to say, the general sentiment of the injured people that have been coming in, and, you know, the injured people being people who have been cracked over the top of the head with police batons, is, you know, all the way to pepper spray, is that despite the fact that they were injured by police, they're not going to become violent. And, you know, this is the sentiment, you know, on my behalf that I would like to put out there.
Sure, Mike, let me put that to, I want to put that to Tim McCarthy, because it's one of the questions I wanted to ask him. How do you think the Occupy protests around the country and in Boston have responded to the police presence, to the police response in general?
One of the things that I was going to add to what my brother Philip here has been talking about in terms of the kinds of things around which there's some consensus in the movement, another element is the nonviolent element of the strategies.
Definitely.
And of the acts of civil disobedience and so forth. The violence that we have seen in this country with respect to the Occupy movement has been violence that has come from the state to the occupation, not from the occupation to the state. Mm-hmm. And it is very clear that we understand that. And that's, I think, a very dear warning to our brothers and sisters in power. Right, there's a long historical record that the people who end up the villains in these stories in history are the people who use violence against those who have pledged themselves to nonviolent civil disobedience, even if they are breaking an unjust law for a larger social justice claim, that those folks end up the heroes. The heroes of the civil rights movement are not the cops who unleashed the dogs and the hoses on the civil rights marchers. Right, the heroes of the abolitionist movement are not the folks who burned down the abolitionist presses. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's important for the 18, you know, political jurisdictions that were on that conference call a couple weeks ago to strategize about how they might uniformly repress these different occupations. It's a clarion call to them to step back for a second and slow their roll and think more carefully about how they want to be remembered in history. I'm a historian, so I take a much longer view on this. The impatience that people have about this movement not having it all figured out in 2 months is ridiculous to me when I think about the long history of social movements and social change in this country and the slow pace of change that actually is also part of our history. So the nonviolent piece of this and the violent reaction to this, I think, is a crucial element of this story that will continue to play in the favor of the occupation and the occupiers rather than the political jurisdictions that are trying to repress those occupations.
Well, speaking of that, what's the best sort of outcome for this movement here in Boston? Is it to allow this tent city down there in Dewey Square to really dig in for the winter? Or, I mean, how important is that?
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
I think it's important to allow the occupation to continue to exist as long as the occupation wants to continue to exist in that space. Mm-hmm. I think that to make sure that we are upholding the rights of free speech and assembly and so forth that I talked about earlier, while at the same time giving space for the occupation itself, for the movement itself to expand and diversify its strategies and its protocols, seems to me that's the best possible case scenario for the movement. If mm-hmm. they do repress and clean out Dewey Square, like they did Zuccotti Park, like they've done in Oakland and in Portland and other places and on certain college campuses, then the movement will have to think and rethink and re-strategize more quickly. But I think in the time being, we'll that remains to be seen. We can't predict the future.
Well, we can't predict the future, but we'll certainly continue to follow the story. Thank you both for coming in. Timothy McCarthy, Director of the Human Rights and Social Movements Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's also author of Protest Nation, Words That Inspired a Century of American Radicalism. Tim, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks so much.
And Philip Anderson, Occupy Boston protester and one of the people behind the website WeCanOccupy.org. Philip Anderson, good luck to you, and thanks for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from The Angle at boston.com. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.